Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming question whether or not Governor Jan Brewer will veto a bill passed last Thursday in the Arizona legislature that allows businesses to deny services to LGBT customers on religious grounds. Stephen Lemons, a columnist for the Phoenix New Times, who covers Arizona politics, joins us to discuss the growing opposition to SB 1062 that sanctions bigotry in the name of religious liberty and could cost the state next year's Super Bowl. Then we'll examine the consequences of the Comcast-Time Warner mega-merger following a deal struck between Comcast and Netflix that could be a glimpse into the future of the Internet. Craig Aaron, the president of Free Press, joins us to discuss the intensifying struggle between content providers like Netflix and the owners of the conduit into the home as we face the prospect of a giant monopoly combining the two largest cable companies, free to charge more for less service as they dominate access to news, information, entertainment, and the Internet. Then finally, with Ukraine's ousted president on the lam and Russia's prime minister calling the new government in Kiev a bunch of armed mutineers, the author of a new book, Russians, The People Behind the Power, Gregory Pfeiffer, a former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio, joins us to discuss growing tensions between Putin and the West, with Russian state media praising the arrest of 500 pro-democracy demonstrators in Moscow and St. Petersburg. We'll examine why an anti-Western posture helps Putin, even if it harms Russia. And joining us now is Stephen Lemons, who is a columnist for the Phoenix New Times, who follows Arizona politics. Some of the most in-depth reporting on Arizona politics can be found at his blog, Feathered Bastard, at phoenixnewtimes.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Lemons.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And what's the latest on in looking into the mind of, indeed, if she has one, Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona?
Well, I think the veto is a foregone conclusion now. It's just a matter of when she will actually issue a veto. The opposition to 1062, Senate Bill 1062 is nearly, universal at this point, with, only some extremists, holding up the banner for it. And, a lot of business interests have weighed in very publicly asking her to veto it. One of her top advisors has gone public with the fact that he's advised her to veto it. So I think it's pretty much, it'll pretty much be over once she, actually pulls the trigger.
But when you say the whole state is against it and the business community is against it, how then did it pass both houses of the legislature?
Well, therein lies the rub. It's like the legislature doesn't always accurately reflect what the population wants, the voting population wants. The problem is we've had a Republican stronghold over the legislature for many years now, and the Republican primaries have become more important for determining who's going to be in the legislature than what happens in November with the general election. So, as in primaries elsewhere, you see, the extremists or more extreme elements demanding sort of like ideological purity, and that's kind of what has happened with, that's what's happened with Arizona and the Arizona legislature, and statewide. You get more moderate Republicans, say if you've Jeff Flake or John McCain, which by our standards would be moderate, or at least what I call sane versus insane. And the same will probably be true in the gubernatorial election. We'll probably have a fairly moderate Republican win, even though the Democrats may get an added boost from this controversy over 1062. But in the legislature, the extremists rule. They have a lot of power, and they're closely aligned with people like Kathy Herod of the Center for Arizona Policy, who's a you know, religious extremist, a bigot, and she has been very adept at wielding influence over the legislature. And she's not the only person like that, but there, these fringe elements, you know, they're not just fringe here. They're the, you know, in the Republican Party, they're the mainstream. That's why you saw a few weeks back the state Republican Party censuring Senator John McCain for not being right-wing enough, basically. So, you know, that that's kind of the situation we have, and it you know, it allowed for the rise of 1070 4 years ago, and, you know, they're passing crazy stuff all the time down the state legislature. The difference is, no, most people don't hear about it, you know, the other crazy stuff, because it doesn't have quite the impact that this had, that 1062 had. But there's other equally insane bills making its way through the legislature, and we're not finished with the legislature. It's just, you know, we're just still just a couple of months in. They've got a couple more months to go, and they have these things called striker bills, which they can pretty much put anything they want to in them. And at the last minute of the legislature, you'll see a lot of really just wacky ideas and insane right-wing lunacies being proffered as possible legislation. And, you know, when you have a Republican governor, it's possible she might sign some of it. So in this case, I don't think so, but that's not because she's particularly adept, but because the business community wields a lot of influence, obviously, and they've reacted very quickly to this bill, unlike in the past with 1070. They sort of dragged their heels with it.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Stephen Lemons, who is a columnist for the Phoenix New Times, who follows Arizona politics, and some of the most in-depth reporting on Arizona's politics can be found at his blog, Feathered Bastard, at phoenixnewtimes.com. Now, I remember once you told me we were talking about Governor Jan Brewer, who, when she was, I think, debating in a political debate when she was running for office, she couldn't remember her own policies. It was the most amazingly embarrassing display. And you sort of mentioned that she's as dumb as a box of hammers. I watched Anderson Cooper talking to Al Melvin, a state senator who supported this bill, that's basically sanctions bigotry in the name of religious freedom. He was unbelievably thick, and I just wonder, is this an anti-intellectual state? Do you really, is it a good thing for politicians to be dumb?
It depends on your district, you know. I mean, the district that Al Melvin represents is, you know, pretty right-wing or pretty red, and so it allows him to get away with his bumbling and his bigotry. You know, he's probably one of the most extreme, you know, right-wing members of the legislature. And, you know, there are a lot like him. You know, he's not, I wouldn't say he's an outlier or anything like that. He's not by, you know, he's well respected within the ranks of the Republican Party. So as far as being anti-intellectual, yeah, there is that extreme. It's not so much anti-intellectual as there's just a really deep strain of right-wing extremism. I mean, going back to the days of the John Birch Society, for instance. Before I moved here about 10 years ago, that was something I figured, you know, you only read about in books, you know, the John Birch Society. It's like, is that still around? You know, but when I came here, did I learn quickly that the John Birch Society is very much alive and well. And, you know, you'll meet there. They'll always have a table at the Republican Party meetings, and they will debate you on whether or not Eisenhower was a communist, and whether or not fluoride should be in the water, and all of these crazy things that you think date back to like 1950s America. Mm-hmm. And so this still has a strong, you know, hold over the state. And I don't, you know, you go back to like Ev Meekum and the fact that the state opposed the Martin Luther King holiday, and you know, so there's a tradition there. Mm-hmm. You could say that this is Al Melvin is in that tradition very much. So,
and, Al Melvin couldn't answer the question repeatedly from Anderson Cooper about the fact that Arizona's constitution does not ban discrimination against gays. It bans discrimination against race and I think and gender and a number of issues in the, you know, the whole panoply of discrimination. But it conspicuously it does not mention discrimination against people on the basis of sexual orientation. So Cooper kept trying to say, well, look, you know, you already, why do you need this law? Because already there's no protection against for discriminating against, same-sex people in your...
It was amusing watching him use reason and logic with someone like right. Melvin. I mean, you know, these are a lot of cases, there's a lot of tinfoil hattery and black helicopter sighting kind of things. You know, I mean, for instance, during the state, from the state Republican main state Republican meeting in January, they were trying to pass, and this was a very vigorous debate that happened on the floor of the state Republican meeting. They had a very vigorous debate over getting rid of the 17th Amendment, which or repealing it, and which is never going to happen. But the 17th Amendment is—I had to look it up. I didn't even know. I was like, "Oh, it's the direct election of senators."
Right, right.
They wanted to go back to
the railroad barons who bought all the legislatures.
Yeah. But like, why would anyone care about that anymore? And secondly, once you start to look into it, you realize that, you know, of course, who's going to argue against direct election of your senators? But this was a vigorous debate on the floor of the Senate. They have other things supporting the 10th Amendment, it's just on and on, you know, this sort of insanity. Recently, they passed out of one of the Senate committees. I don't know how far it'll get because it's been vetoed in the past, but this notion of recognizing gold and silver as legal tender. I mean, it's you get like this is the kind of stuff that regularly pops up. Another one is Common Core, which is a Common Core curricula that basically it's business and state governments are involved in trying to, you know, raise the standards of children who are being educated in, you know, K-12, and they regard Common Core, the extremists regard Common Core as being Obama Core, that's what they call it, and they think it's like some way of like manipulating young minds into becoming Marxists, you know. And there are actually bills that have been passed through committee in the state Senate which, you know, want to opt out of Common Core. So it's like, you know, it makes no sense. It's like it's illogical, but this is what you get when you're talking about the fringe of either party, really. I mean, you know, I'm not saying the Democrats don't have their fringe. They certainly do, but the problem is, you know, the thing is here, they don't have any power. They have zero power. So, you know, maybe if that changed and things were to flip, they might be running there. But, you know, you have a one-party state that's, you know, for this long with a carte blanche and a sort given to these people and the business community basically allowing this sort of, far-right, extremism to flourish, you know.
Except until now, apparently. They're putting their foot down. I mean, it's sort of like the joke of Andy Borowitz is that Arizona's confronting the awkward realization that gay people have money and buy stuff.
Exactly. You know, money's not gay or straight, right?
Right. They beat up on the Latinos and now they're beating up on the gays and realize maybe they've gone one prejudice too far.
Yeah, they jumped the shark on this one, but, you know, I mean, that's the thing is, it wouldn't surprise me at all, even if she vetoes it, if they try to come back at the 11th hour of the legislature and try to pass something else that's very similar. So,
well, Stephen Lemons, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Sure, here. It's always fun.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Lemons, who's a columnist for the Phoenix New Times, who follows Arizona politics, and some of the most in-depth reporting on Arizona politics can be found at his blog, Feathered Bastard, at phoenixnewtimes.com. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the growing tensions between Putin and the West. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Craig Aaron, the president of Free Press, and also the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Policies for a Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizens Congress Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Aaron.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And this mega merger between Comcast and Time Warner, the two biggest cable companies now joining in a mega merger into a giant monopoly. I have to tell you, Craig, I'm speaking to you from literally across the street from Universal Studios, and they just changed the logo on the giant black tower to say Comcast, Universal, etc. So they barely got through one merger, and they're onto another. I mean, but I take it you think that the deal that was just struck between Comcast and Netflix is a kind of harbinger of how things are going to be in the future in terms of who controls the internet?
Well, I do think it's a glimpse of what's to come, although if Comcast and can take over Time Warner Cable, it will be a lot worse than this deal that was negotiated this week. This is maybe a precursor, if nothing else. I think both sides of that deal, from Netflix perspective, they figured, hey, let's make a deal before new giant Comcast is here. And from Comcast perspective, they thought, well, let's get this done and maybe Netflix won't be a prominent opponent of our merger. But this merger is a whole another thing when it comes to media power. I mean, this would make Comcast, which did just take over NBC just a couple of years ago, almost an unprecedented media giant. I mean, really exercising control over cable TV, over programming, and most importantly, over the future of the internet, not to mention exercising control over the political processes that dictate the media policies we end up with.
Well, it's pretty clear that for some time now, there's been a contest between the content providers and the owners of the conduit. And I guess some power ebbs and flows in that regard. But this merger surely would mean tremendous power on the part of the conduit and very limited leverage now on or in the future on the part of the content provider.
Well, that's what's so scary about this is that Comcast is both. They're both a programmer, a content provider, and the conduit, and there's the problem. Because they're trying to position themselves to be a gatekeeper in all those businesses and all of those markets. So they're in a situation where a company like Netflix, which competes with them when it comes to the video business, has to go through them to actually reach the customers it's trying to reach. That's a tremendous amount of power. And if they can add Time Warner Cable to the fold, they will become the dominant cable company in two-thirds of the country. That's an incredible amount of power, an incredible amount of leverage in any of these debates, whether they're going face-to-face with the broadcasters, and they're also a broadcaster, whether they're going to cable channels, they're also a cable bunch, own a bunch of cable channels, or whether it's the internet, where they're both trying to compete and provide content, and they own the pipes. That is just way too much power concentrated in too few hands.
Well, one of the things that I most like about Netflix, particularly having sat through this binge of House of Cards.
Don't ruin it for me. I'm only at episode 5.
No, I'm not going to, but I'm telling you, it's addictive, and it's really well done. And one of the reasons it's really well done is that these new companies joining the media world are simply just writing the checks and letting the creative community here in Hollywood make the movies, which does not happen at the big networks like NBC, Universal, Comcast, where they have legions of vice presidents who nibble the scripts to death and micromanage the casting, etc. And you end up with this bland garbage that dominates television with these artificial laugh tracks on extremely unfunny sitcoms. So I know it's not not your purview, but to me, that's a great loss. That if you know, if we lose the Netflix and the Amazons and these new players in this market who are doing so much better than the old players, then we're just stuck with this dreadful poverty of choice that we already have with these existing cable providers.
Well, and that's been the beauty of the internet and the beauty of actual competition is it creates new things that customers want and serves audiences that weren't being served. And what Comcast wants is something completely different. They want a cut of all that. They want to be in control of all that. And they want to undercut these competitors like Netflix and others who are entering this space. And at a moment when, as viewers, we want more choices. We want on-demand. The technology is there. There's no reason for there to be a cable channel just airing, you know, Law and Order or, you know, name your sitcom reruns hour after hour. We should be able to go in, find what we want when we want it. That's what the internet makes possible. That's why so many people are willing to subscribe and pay for Netflix. But now Comcast is trying to insert themselves into that conversation and trying to control how we access that. A lot of us want HBO Go. Maybe that's what we would pay for. We like the HBO model. But we can't. In order to get it, we have to pay for 500 or 600 other channels locked into Comcast. Same if you like sports. You want ESPN? Sorry. You can't just get ESPN online. You're going to have to buy all these other channels, be a cable customer. That's how Comcast knows how to make money, and that's what they're trying to lock down. And I think it does have real ramifications for the creative community because a free and open internet gives an opportunity for lots of different kinds of experiments, allows them to reach an audience just because they put on the best show or came up with the funniest idea or had something important to say. That's what the internet makes possible. But if every time you want to do that, you have to go ask Comcast for permission, or you have to go, even worse, go cut them in, give them a piece of the back end or what have you, it diminishes the opportunities for that kind of creative expression, for new and disruptive things to happen, and it's going to decrease the investment too. Because if you didn't have to go through Comcast, there'd be a lot of people trying to solve this problem, and hey, how do we have virtual cable companies? Even Time Warner, they're trying to take over. They were negotiating with Apple to build new devices and offer a virtual cable service. That's all going to go away with Comcast literally running everything.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Aaron, who is the president of Free Press and the editor and co-author of Changing Media Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch. So just in terms of this landscape that we're talking about, that we have, one, the possibility, in terms of good news, the possibility that this, you know, it's hard not for anybody not to notice that this is an antitrust issue, this merge of the two biggest cable companies into one giant cable company. Their excuse is, no, we don't have customers in the same markets, which is a de facto recognition that we already have monopolies at any rate. And then
right, we already made it a cartel.
Exactly. So two questions. One is what's it look like on the antitrust front? And two, the ruling that Verizon won before the D.C. Court of Appeals, which looked like it was the end of the or the beginning of the end of net neutrality, it looks like the FCC may be doing the right thing there. So let's begin with that.
Sure. Well, so in terms of antitrust, you know, this is certainly something that's going to have to go through the Justice Department. And the question is really going to be, how are they going to draw these markets? Now, to their credit, the Obama administration has put a few teeth back into antitrust enforcement. They put a lot of pressure on the airline merger. They actually blocked AT&T and T-Mobile's merger, which is, you know, in the telecommunications space. So there's some good precedent there. The challenge is going to be the question you raised, which is these companies are trying to claim, hey, we don't compete. We've already carved up the country. There won't be a decrease in competition. You'll still have the same choice, just the letterhead will change. But I think when you look at the scope of the power this company would have, this is actually why we're supposed to have antitrust rules. Even if they never added a new customer, these companies already control a third of the pay TV market. They already control more than half of the triple play market when they're bundling together voice, video, and internet. That's a lot of concentration. And if these companies are allowed to get together, they will be the dominant cable company and broadband provider, high-speed broadband provider, in two-thirds of the country. So that is a really big footprint with a lot of power. And for a lot of Americans, nearly half, if this deal happens, their only true viable high-speed broadband provider will be Comcast. There's in some big markets, there's some competition from Verizon or AT&T, but in most places, the only actual broadband offering is coming from the cable company, and that's really too much power. So I think Justice is going to have to scrutinize that, but how they go about doing it will dictate, you know, a lot of whether they step in and block this. The FCC, though, has a different standard. The FCC standard is supposed to be, are deals like this in the public interest? That's a higher standard, a more complex standard, and I think the one we should be applying to this merger is letting these two companies get together in the public interest. I don't see how the FCC is going to be able to twist itself into knots to say that it is for the public interest. So net neutrality is a very important issue in this debate. It itself is a little bit complicated. Comcast, because of its last merger, is actually required to abide by old net neutrality rules until 2018. That's a little bit of cold comfort because in 5 years from now, I don't know about you, but I'd actually like to still have an open internet. But they are under a certain kind of obligation. They've offered already to just extend that to the combined company. I think the problem there is what you need to look at is what are the long-term ramifications. And Comcast has been very clear everywhere they go when they're talking to investors, when they're talking to trade shows, their vision for the future of the internet is not the free and open internet we have now. It is an internet that looks like cable television, where they pick and choose the channels for you, where they decide which websites work and which don't, which services go fast and which go slow. They want to control that. They want to favor their own content and services, and they want to favor the content and services of the companies that are willing to pay them. That's their vision, and you're starting to see that happen, not at the last mile, which is where net neutrality applies between Comcast and your house, but back in the backbone of the internet. And that's where you get into this whole debate with Netflix, is that Comcast is exploiting its market power, the fact that Netflix needs to reach those customers' eyeballs to have a business, to extract extra rents from them, to ask them for more money. So even though I'm already paying my broadband provider, you know, $80, $90, $100 a month, because I want to watch Netflix, that's what I give them money for, to request that traffic. So Comcast has figured out, hey, we can charge extra. And the reason they can is because there's not enough competition. It's too hard for me to choose a different provider, or in my case, I'd have to switch from Verizon to Comcast, which is pretty cold comfort. There's just no way for their customers to vote with their feet. So instead of having to serve those customers and respond to their needs, and what they're saying is, hey, we want more Netflix, invest in your network. Right. Instead, they charge you and they charge Netflix. Everybody's prices goes up.
Well, Craig Aaron, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Aaron, who is the president of Free Press and the editor and co-author of Changing Media Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the Comcast-Netflix deal as a glimpse into the future of the internet. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gregory Pfeiffer, a former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio, who has reported from Russia for almost a decade. In 2008, he covered the Russia-Georgia war from the breakaway Georgian region of South Ossetia and traveled to Siberia, Belgrade, and Berlin to produce a series on the Kremlin's use of Gazprom, the Russian gas monopoly, as an instrument of foreign policy. He witnessed the coup d'etat attempt against Mikhail Gorbachev in 1991 and later examined the end of the Yeltsin era and Russia's subsequent transformation into an authoritarian state. Pfeiffer, whose mother is Russian, lived in Paris and New York and is the author of The Great Gamble, A History of the Soviet War in Afghanistan, and co-author of Spy Handler with former KGB General Viktor Chekhushin. His latest book just out is Russians, The People Behind the Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
And your book takes the reader from the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 to Putin's re-election for a third term as president in 2012. And just on Monday, there were 500 people arrested for rallies both in Moscow and St. Petersburg in support of seven people who received prison terms for demonstrating against Putin's inauguration for his third presidential term. So there's the kind of bookends there, I guess. Among them were some fairly prominent opposition figures, Alexei Navalny, two of the Pussy Riot band members who were just released from prisons, and former Deputy Prime Minister Boris Nemtsov. What I find disturbing about this, Gregory, is the way that the Russian media, which is totally controlled by Putin, praised the arrests and linked them to the events in Kiev in the Maidan, saying it's even more obvious that what all of this could have led to had it not been for the government's clear, tough response. So there you have, you know, the government praising the arrest of dissidents and linking them to the terrorists, as they call them, in Kiev. So it's a pretty sad day for the Russian opposition, wouldn't you say?
It is indeed. I think the lesson that Vladimir Putin has drawn from the events in Ukraine is precisely not to let that kind of thing happen in Russia. Now, he's not going to do that by opening up political system in any way, increasing free speech. He's doing it by cracking down against all of his rivals. And he's been remarkably consistent. This is something he's done from the very first day he came to power in 2000. He has slowly gotten rid of his rivals, cracked down on civil society, and the thing that I think that he's very successful at doing and has been from the start is presenting different faces to different people. I don't know if you remember the first 4 years of his presidency during his first term, he was hailed in the West as a great reformer. I remember he traveled to London in 2003 to meet Tony Blair, and the Times of London called him the greatest Russian ruler since Alexander II, who freed the serfs in 1861. He's a master of appearances. He appears tough when he wants to. He appears more conciliatory and even sometimes fuzzy and warm, like he did to some people during the Sochi Winter Olympics that just ended. And I think he's done that by essentially tapping into a centuries-old political culture in Russia. This is part of his success. He's been able to use facades, often facades that are taken from adopting to Western influences, and using them to hide what really has been a very traditional Russian system where decisions are made in secret and essentially are covered up. This is what I talk about in the book.
But at this point, events, I mean, in many ways, his policy makes what's happening in Ukraine and Kiev a zero-sum game. He basically said to Yanukovych, you know, it's either us or the EU, and it's going to have to be us, and we'll give you $15 billion. And that's already blown up in his face. But in covering the events in Ukraine, Russian media, which is entirely controlled by Putin, has demonized the opposition to the point calling them terrorists, and even the Prime Minister Medvedev said the other day that that was an armed mutiny. So I'm wondering if Russia can, have they trapped themselves? Have the leadership trapped themselves in this kind of rhetoric that would, on the part of their public, expect some kind of intervention in Ukraine?
Well, I think the Kremlin has shown itself to be pragmatic at times. Putin has often in the past supported authoritarian leaders who have been toppled. He supported them to the very last minute and then essentially changed his tune. We saw that with Slobodan Milosevic in 2001. Putin was his staunch ally till the last minute. And after he was arrested by the Serbian authorities, he immediately quieted down. The Kremlin has not so far intervened using force in Ukraine. That was the biggest fear. But I think it will continue to use various underhanded methods, essentially using its old playbook to try to bribe and threaten the Ukrainians to abandon joining the EU and looking west and try to forge closer ties with Russia. Now, officials in the EU in the West rightly say that this doesn't need to be a choice; that it's not a zero-sum game. But for Putin, it is. And part of the reason, I think, is that he makes decisions that are in his interest, not in Russia's or the Russian people's. Things like directing or threatening to direct nuclear missiles at Western Europe and over the years cutting off gas to Ukraine has been very bad for Russia's image in the world. But at home, it's shown Putin to be tough. And that's helped shore up his base of conservative voters. You know, we've just seen in Ukraine that Putin has helped push the country to the verge of civil war by pressuring the Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych to abandon a deal with the EU last year. So, you know, I think that these things are all, as I say, good for Putin because they show him to be trying to restore Russia's greatness. He wants Ukraine to join the so-called Eurasian Union, which would be an organization that counters the West. Without Ukraine, this organization would essentially be toothless. Ukraine is too big and important a partner for Russia. So I think he will continue to do that. After the Orange Revolution in 2004, the Kremlin was very worried that the same thing could happen in Moscow, very worried that it was losing its influence in its backyard. But I think Putin has learned lessons, and I think he's sort of playing a long game. Ukraine isn't going anywhere, and Russia will keep doing what it's been doing in the past.
Again, I'm speaking with Gregory Pfeiffer, a former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio, who has reported from Russia for almost a decade. He is the author of The Great Gamble, A History of the Soviet War in Afghanistan, and co-author of Spy Handler with former KGB Colonel Viktor Cherashkin. And his latest book just out is Russians, The People Behind the Power. Well, we have, of course, the interim president of the Ukraine warning of dangers of separatism. Apparently, the Russian-speaking regions to the east are not recognizing this government. And, of course, Yanukovych is on the lam. His aide was apparently shot in the leg. Do you think that there is any possibility of the Ukraine breaking up?
I think certainly there's a possibility. I don't think it's a very big possibility. I do think Ukrainians, despite their differences, want to remain together in one country. We've seen that this is a country that has a very strong civil society despite the authoritarianism. We've seen people rise up and topple their very corrupt authoritarian leader. These differences are historic. Ukraine is split essentially 50-50 between its Russian-speaking east and Ukrainian-speaking, generally Ukrainian-speaking west. It's also divided 50-50 by population. This is one of the reasons that this conflict in Ukraine is so intractable. But I think we saw signs before Yanukovych came to power in 2010 of the two sides kind of warming to each other. And I think that the candidacy of Yulia Tymoshenko, the former prime minister who ran for president and was narrowly defeated by Yanukovych in 2010, there were signs that her campaign was bringing the two sides together, that people in the east were beginning to support her, and that a sense of sort of national unity was emerging. I think it's very possible. I think Ukrainians on the whole want to look west. They want to join the EU. This is why they rose up when, Yanukovych had been in power for several years. He'd done some terrible things. He'd jailed Tymoshenko. He'd cracked down on the free press. It was well known that he was corrupt, but it was the decision to abandon a deal with the EU that prompted these protests. So I think there is a desire for that, and I'm optimistic, despite the fragile nature of the attempts to form a unity government now. I'm optimistic that Ukraine can do so.
Well, certainly if Tymoshenko is the anointed leader, that's a step backwards. She's a minor kleptocrat compared to Yanukovych, of course, who his oldest son, the dentist, shook down the billionaires, and overnight they become one of the richest families in Ukraine. But she, of course, Yulia Tymoshenko, has one of her closest aides was arrested for money laundering, and the assumption is it's her money that he was laundering, and she was a catastrophe as prime minister. So one would hope that that new leadership could emerge, and as you've mentioned, Gregory Pfeiffer, the Russians are going to meddle as much as they can and thwart any movement towards the West. But given the choice between a kind of gangster regime in the East and joining a civil society in the West, a country that's rife with corruption, which is weighing down any chances of forming businesses and affecting the daily lives of every Ukrainian who have to pay bribes, the choice would seem pretty clear. Why is there no such choice in Russia? In other words, people accept Putin, if not like him, and the reformers, those people that were just arrested on Monday, have very little traction.
That's a very, very good question. I'd just like to say two words about Tymoshenko, and that is I can't agree with your assessment. Yes, she did amass a huge fortune in the natural gas business, the very murky natural gas business in the 90s. She made a lot of mistakes as prime minister, but she learned from her lessons. I think that she also essentially sacrificed a lot of her political power in the years leading up to the election of Yanukovych, staving off his attacks on the essentially the Orange Revolution team that was in government. So yes, she is a problematic figure, but many, many politicians are. I think she's one of the better candidates. She's been staunchly pro-EU. She has learned from her mistakes. She's a very charismatic figure. I don't necessarily think that her presidency would be a step backward. But let me just say about Russia, why is it that Russians aren't rising up like the Ukrainians did? And this is really the question at the heart of my book. Why is it that two decades after the Soviet collapse, do Russians continue to support their authoritarian leader who's destroyed democracy and jailed his political opponents? Does that mean that they've learned absolutely nothing from their painful past? My approach in my book has been to look at Russians' daily behavior, their family life, their work, drinking. And what's clear to me in my travels, many travels across Russia, is that Russians' way of doing things may seem odd and confusing and chaotic to us, but it is successful in achieving its own aims. Now, these aren't Western aims. I think Russians' values and motives are different than ours, but they do function according to their own internal logic, and that's something that we really need to understand.
So how much, though, did the failure of Yeltsin contribute to this jaundiced view of Western democracy?
I don't think Yeltsin is necessarily a failure. I think he did a lot of good for the country. A lot of reforms were made in the 1990s that gave hope that the country could fundamentally change. And I think it's still possible that the country can change, because I think that Russians' behavior needn't be as mysterious as it seems to us. I think it's based on, its own internal logic, and it's based on practical reasons. Putin came to power when Yeltsin was sick. The country was suffering from economic crisis in 1998, and he was picked to succeed Yeltsin in the hope that he would be able to protect the Yeltsin circle, Yeltsin's entourage. This is somebody who was basically an unknown with no power base of his own, and he was a brilliant student of the traditional Russian political system, not only under the Soviet Union, but for hundreds of years under the Tsars, and he was able to essentially reactivate it. I'll just give you an example. The conventional wisdom is that Putin essentially established an unwritten social contract with the people, that he was been in power for 14 years, because as long as living standards continue rising, thanks to the country's vast natural energy resources, basically the Kremlin is more or less free to be as authoritarian as it likes. I don't believe that's true. I think that the real glue binding Putin's system to the Russian people is corruption. I think that bribery, I mean, we all know, it's well known that bribery affects absolutely everybody. If you drive a car, you are inevitably stopped by the traffic police, and you inevitably pay a bribe to get out of it. If you're the owner of a corner store, for example, you pay the building inspector, the fire code inspector, the health code inspector. Now, this enables the authorities pretty much to prosecute anybody, because anybody can be accused of wrongdoing. So I think bribery coerces people. But I also think it co-opts people, because I think that people feel that they're getting at least something out of the system, that they have a stake in it too. So, for example, the corner store owner who pays the police to ensure that no harm comes to his business, maybe he feels that he's got something over his competition a couple blocks down the street.
So you don't think that in the end of the day that's corrosive, though? I mean, it seems to be that way in the Ukraine.
Certainly, it is corrosive. It's very, very difficult for Putin to control the system. And although he has control over parliament and the courts and the state media, it's a very shaky control, because he doesn't have a popular mandate in that he wasn't elected in free and fair elections. And essentially, his system consists of appointing regional thugs, sort of the biggest thugs in the provinces, to be sort of loyal leaders. You know, do whatever you want in your region, but make sure you're loyal to the Kremlin. But I think one of the reasons that he's been able to do this successfully is that, as I said earlier, that he's been able to present these facades. Now, I think this is something that Russian leaders have often done in the past, adopting foreign influences that resulted in what turned out to be clearly more traditionally Russian. From the laws of Catherine the Great that omitted many elements of Enlightenment thought that she said they reflected, to the tone and practice of Soviet communism, which surely would have dumbfounded Marx. Now, I think one of the clearest examples of this was the presidency of Putin's protege Dmitry Medvedev, who took office after Putin's first two consecutive term limit ran out. Now, Western leaders spent the 4 years of his tenure trying to guess when this man would assume the vast powers of his office. But, of course, as we know now, that never happened, and Putin returned to his old job. And that's because Medvedev's sort of reforming Western-looking image served to conceal the real ruler, Putin. And I think this sort of creating a facade, obfuscating what's going on, enables Putin to successfully rule as he has done for 14 years, and he doesn't look like he's stepping down anytime soon.
Well, I guess that's kind of the Matryoshka metaphor, right? Or the riddled and wrapped in an enigma. But you say that in your book, Gregory Pfeiffer, Russians, the People Behind the Power, that Putin is chief among a collection of officials whose rule more closely resembles those of mafia dons than public servants. And I'm wondering, there was a recent expose on what happened to the lawyer Magnitsky on 60 Minutes, which was quite damning. And for the longest time, I've talked to Russian specialists and people like Masha Gessen and Nina Khrushcheva and others who obviously don't like what's been happening in Russia over the last decades or so through Putin. And I'm wondering what the advantage of treating this guy with respect is, you know, because one of the things that gangsters yearn for is respect. And it seems that there's so much smoke in terms of his thuggishness, let alone presiding over and regulating the other thugs, that one wonders exactly whether, you know, you're dealing with. I mean, it's the same thing in effect that happened between Chamberlain and Hitler with the famous Munich Pact, where historians have concluded that Chamberlain, being an old-fashioned English gentleman, simply didn't realize he was dealing with a gangster and a thug who took him to the cleaners. And that appears to be what's been happening lately. It looks like Putin's taken us to the cleaners over Syria, for example.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, we wonder why Putin does these kinds of things, put egg on President Obama's face over Syria, his actions in Ukraine. And, you know, as I was saying, I think we have a tendency to find Russia a riddle, as Churchill said, or we explain what we don't understand about Russians by saying, well, you know, they have a mystical Russian soul that's that we can't understand because it's different. As I said, I think that our sort of the beginning of our dealing with Putin in the right way, and I agree with you that this is somebody who craves respect and that we have to understand that, is precisely to understand his motives, which are very clear. They're not a mystery. So, for example, you know, Putin has generated a great deal of bad press by jailing Pussy Riot and passing an anti-gay law, among many other relatively recent restrictions. But that's politically smart. You know, polls say that almost two-thirds of Russians condemn homosexuality as morally unacceptable. You know, Putin's nationalism works because many Russians envy the West, and they support his claims of Russian exceptionalism. You know, I once heard a joke that Americans love their country and hate everyone who disagrees with them, and that Russians dislike their country and hate everyone who agrees with them. Now, you know, that may be a bit harsh, but you know, although today is a far cry from the Cold War, Putin does regularly denounce the United States, and it's popular. As I say, I think the trick is to understand why he's doing these things, and I don't think we do. I think we continue to think of Putin as a rational character in the Western sense, and so we're always surprised why, as I say, he takes decisions in his own interests and not in his country's. But I do think that Russia can change. I don't believe it's fated to remain the same. You know, I think the society is changing, and I think now the economy is creating a lot of pressure on Putin. Russia's dominance over the energy market, exports to Europe, is wavering. Russia, the economy inside Russia is starting it's not starting to decline, but economic growth certainly is starting to decline to very small numbers at the same time that dependence on oil is growing. I mean, in 2005, Russia could balance its budget if oil was around $20 a barrel. Today, it has to be around $103. Now the price for Russian oil is around $108. So the Kremlin is very worried what will happen if oil continues to fall. And I think this also partly accounts for, you know, the crackdown against protesters, the nationalism, the desire to appear strong.
Again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Gregory Pfeiffer, former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio, who has reported from Russia for almost a decade. He is the author of The Great Gamble, A History of the Soviet War in Afghanistan, and co-author of Spy Handler with former KGB Colonel Viktor Cherkashin. His latest book just out is Russians, The People Behind the Power. It couldn't be more topical given the conversation, since so much of Russia has been in the news, not just with the recent Olympics, but now with this new possible crisis, even a revival of kind of Cold War hostilities over Ukraine. Clearly, it would be a massive loss to Russia to have Ukraine move into the Western orbit, and it would be a disaster for Ukraine to split between its Eastern minority and its Western majority. So what's your sense then of the takeaway from your book?
Well, the takeaway is that although Russians' behavior seems confusing and confounding to foreigners, that really if you look at patterns and behavior, that it's really quite understandable. It's based on practical reasons, but these are practical reasons that come from the system's own internal logic. Russians share different values than we do in the West. They share different goals, and I think that one of the tasks in front of us is to try to understand them. I think Russia can change, but I think that reforming the country will take more than just new leadership. It will require a fundamental change precisely in that behavior that makes it seem so mystifying to us today.
Well, I spent through the Cold War a lot of time in Russia working on arms control and also working in the anti-nuclear movement with the nuclear freeze here in California and working for a group in Washington, the Center for Defense Information, about the possibility of a nuclear war, which was a real issue, a real and growing, a clear and present danger back then. And it is a miracle that we survived the Cold War, given how many near misses and misperceptions, and much of that still is classified to this day. But, you know, I've always had this a tremendous affection for the Russian people, and it always seemed like such an unnecessary and unnatural competition. There's no inherent reason for the Russians and the Americans to oppose each other and to be enemies. There's no historical or cultural motivation, really. It just seems to be an accident of history. And it seems such a great tragedy that we're heading back into that direction.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that Russian behavior has been influenced over centuries by some of the country's distinctive characteristics. It's the biggest country in the world by territory. Much of its land is uninhabitable. It's marsh and tundra. It has a famously terrible winter. I think all of these things do affect behavior. But I don't believe that means that it's fated to continue doing the same things over and over again. And I think also that these characteristics have also helped fuel a tremendous creativity in art, in dancing, in literature, and many other endeavors. You know, Russia is a country of huge paradoxes. You know, the vast size, the immense wealth in some things, and the terrible, terrible poverty. I mean, if you just look at it today, we had the spectacle of the Olympic Games, you know, the most expensive games ever, famously corrupt. And yet you have a country where the countryside is literally dying. I mean, I visit villages where there's one or two elderly people left living in what used to be villages but is now an abandoned, muddy track. Disease, alcoholism kills a fifth of Russian men. You know, in many ways, this is a country that's heading toward crisis. On the other hand, it's a country in which its creative people, trying to struggle with these paradoxes, come up with amazing literature, amazing art, and so it's a place that just continues to fascinate.
Well, Gregory Pfeiffer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.